Welcome to the Faded Spade Podcast with your hosts, Tom Wheaton and Sean McCormick.
All right, everyone, welcome back to the Faded Spade Podcast. My name is Tom Wheaton, founder and CEO of Faded Spade, and we are here for the next Founder Hour interview with Mr. Phil Galfond, Mr. RIO, Run It Once Poker Training. You all well know about his latest business venture, Run It Once Poker. Long live poker, Phil. Here we go. This is the untold entrepreneurial story of Mr. Phil Galfond. What's up, brother?
What's up? Long live poker.
Long live poker, baby. Yeah. Man, I was going through just some research in terms of like setting up that intro, which I didn't say half the things I wanted to say. Because, you know, you and I know each other just from getting to know each other through lunches, a couple beverages here and there, talking business. But I did not realize you actually have $3 million in career tournament earnings on top of the cash game, you know, play that you do. I knew it was a lot, but I didn't know it was $3 million, brother.
I didn't either, actually. I it's been a while. I don't really consider myself a tournament player, but I've played in enough of them over the years that I guess that number has climbed.
Yeah. Well, I know we're going to get into the story of Run It Once Poker, right? I kind of look at Run It Once as it's this new, improved, real money online poker site built by and for poker players, led by you, right? And your entire online career experience, trying to make it a very player-centric online poker platform, trying to improve the game for the whole industry. It's an unbelievable business. I know the sky's the limit for you. We'll definitely get into that. But this is the untold entrepreneurial story of you, brother. So,
well, thank you for all the kind words about Run It Once Poker. But yeah, let's get into it.
Let's get into it. So here we go, man. For folks who know your poker journey, right? And they may only know Run It Once Training. They may only know Run It Once Poker. But we know there's a whole other story there. So take everybody back to your roots, right? So where are you from? You know, where'd you grow up? And as you were growing up, you know, was poker even a part of your life, or were entrepreneurial kind of ventures a part of your life?
So I grew up in Maryland, just outside of Washington, D.C. There from ages 0 to 18. I had a pretty, I had a good, comfortable childhood, which is, you know, I mean, everybody has their childhood things, but for the most part, had a very lucky childhood. And, you know, I was always, interested and kind of like, stronger at, you know, math, science. Poker itself didn't really come into the picture for a little while. I guess in some ways it did. So when I was around 12, my group of friends and I, we began gambling a lot.
Oh, shit.
so we would, I mean, it was poker, but it was like, it's a bunch of games that I've never seen played anywhere other than in the houses of my friends when I was, you know, ages 12 through like 17. And so it became like our go-to thing. I don't know, once or twice a week we'd get together and we'd play poker for, I call it, it is poker, but I never really thought of it as poker. Like I still don't think of it as poker. It's just like random games, you know, that I've never heard of since. But yeah, we'd play, you know, late into the night for much more money than we should have been playing for. But throughout all that time, I was never like, I mean, I was probably better than the average player, but I was not like I was not a standout, and I was not thinking of poker in the way that I do now. It was like, there was definitely, once I started taking poker seriously, like one of the biggest flips that switched was simply thinking about like the game strategically. Before it's just like, you look at your hand and you look at the board, or you look at what's going on and you just do what you want to do. And I remember when I just started playing online, this is skipping ahead, we can go back, but I just remember like playing any ace from any position and then like getting my stack in when I flopped an ace every time, and then feeling so unlucky that he always had an ace with a better other card. And like it didn't occur to me to think of, you know, I don't know, strategy beyond that.
Yeah. When you're, you know, 12 to 15, you're just hanging out in your house or around your neighbor's buddies. I would just call it playing cards, right?
Yeah.
Just hanging out, shooting the breeze, playing cards.
So we played cards a lot. And we played cards a lot. And I liked gambling, like beyond playing with them. Even when I got older, I enjoyed like blackjack before I found poker. So I've always had that gambling itch, I guess. And as far as one memory that stands out to me because of where I kind of ended up with poker training is I was in high school engineering class and had a really good teacher, Mr. Pat. Shout out Mr. Pat. And we would do projects where we would have some kind of engineering task that we'd try to accomplish, like try to build, you know, a mini robot or just something that did something. And then we would write about it in kind of a longish form essay about, you know, what worked, what didn't, what we learned, some concepts that, you know, that we, you know, broke down. And one day after class, he asked me to stay behind because he wanted to talk to me. And Mr. Pat said, you know, Phil, there are people who spew right outside of DC's. Like there's a section in the Washington Post where, you know, people, these authors write about, you know, scientific studies and scientific, just like things in science. And they explain it in a way that everybody can understand, like the readers of all the readers. And I think that's something you'd be really good at because in your writing, you break down some complicated topics in ways that are easy for people to digest and understand. And I never took his advice and I never looked into that really as a career path. But as it turns out, I've ended up breaking down complex topics in ways that a lot of people can understand as a big part of my career.
Yeah, it's almost like you developed that skill set then, or you naturally had that skill set then, didn't really know it, right? But teacher saw that in you.
Yeah.
Even though you didn't take part in what he was asking to do, it naturally came back in terms of poker. That's wild.
Yeah.
So were you like a really good student or was school kind of like, and was there like a college path or anything like that?
No. So I was a bad student. I mean, I was well-behaved. I was always a well-behaved student. Teachers for the most part liked me, I guess, until high school when I just refused to do any of my homework. But no, I was pretty lazy. I think it's kind of a typical, like, you know, elementary school was extremely easy for me. And I didn't have to put in any work. And then by the time you get to like middle school, high school, you can't get by with zero work. But I had already developed habits of getting by with zero work. And so I never developed good study habits. And so I was probably a B student with, you know, like I was like a 3.0 GPA in high school. But did that by, you know, doing well on tests and doing 0% of my homework.
Yeah, you and me both, brother.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, I was always a good. I always followed the rules. A well-behaved kid.
Did you go to college? Did you graduate college? Was it a path you actually wanted to do?
I didn't really care. I did go to college. I didn't graduate. So, I mean, my mom basically had to apply to colleges for me because I just didn't care. But to my parents, you know, it wasn't an option to not go. And ended up going to University of Wisconsin, which I loved. And you know, I was studying philosophy at that point.
Oh wow! I can see that.
And but you know, poker dug its claws into me, and that was that. I dropped out during my junior year.
It tends to do that. Like I remember the first time I played. Fortunately, like in a way that actually mattered was at the end of college. So I was already on the path of graduating, but. It dug its claws in me too, as you know. But so how did it dig its claws into you? Do you remember the first time where it just grabbed you and you said, I need to do this more and more and I can learn this and become great at this?
It happened slowly. I mean, a big turning point for me was a good friend of mine from, you know, ages 5 to till then, who played in, you know, who played cards with me throughout middle school and high school. He won a tournament on party poker for $30,000 or something. Yep. This is when we were 19, and he maybe 18 or 19. And obviously that was, you know, big news in our group of friends.
Yeah.
And he reached out to me directly and said, you know, Phil, I I've been playing kind of seriously and I've picked up some books and have been learning a little bit about it. I think you'd be really good at this. So I know you like I'd recommend that you, you know, pick up some strategy books and, you know, give it a shot, give learning the game a shot.
Do you remember your first few strategy books?
I know my first one was a really bad one. And I don't remember, I probably wouldn't say.
I was going to say, let's hear it.
But the second book that I got was Hold'em Poker for Advanced Players by David Sklansky. And that was a really good book. It's focused on limit hold'em, I think, but a lot of theoretical concepts there. And through that, I found the 2+2 forums, which at that time were super rich in strategy discussion and kind of happened upon Sit and Goes. I don't really know why, but I started in Sit and Goes. You know, playing a $10 sit and goes with a $40 bankroll.
And we all did though.
Yeah.
In 200 multi tables with a $1,000 bankroll.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, slowly, I slowly got to the point where, I mean, it took some time and, but I did get to the point where I was winning consistently and, you know, making something like $10, $15 an hour. And that was during my early in my sophomore year of college. Because I started playing like towards the end of my freshman year and over that summer. So it was early in my sophomore year. I felt like I was, you know, making $10, $15 an hour. And I was like, okay, I don't need to get another job. I had gotten another job as actually an SAT tutor for Kaplan, but I just completed the training and then never, that like that was around the time that it happened. I was like, okay, I don't need to do this. I just play poker and, you know, slowly progress from there. I mean, quickly, if you think about it, cause I was, you know, going from making $10, $15 an hour to, you know, at like, I don't know what it was, $10, $20 sit and goes, to within a year I was playing the, you know, $100, $200 sit and goes and dabbled in some 1K sit and goes and things that I shouldn't have been doing.
Did you have bankroll management to get up that high, or did you just freaking go for it a bunch of times? Like, what was that process like?
I went for it a bunch of times. Yeah. I mean, it's I had that gambling itch. Oh, yeah. And it just, it was exciting. And I've been fortunate that I have I kind of naturally had the capacity to step back down when I needed to. I know a lot of people who, you know, if they lose $1,000 playing $100 sit and goes and they go play $1,000 sit and go and they lose another $1,000, they don't go back to $100 sit and goes or $50 sit and goes. They stay in the thousands till they have zero. And that was never really a problem for me. I always was comfortable dropping back down, and I kind of viewed playing the stakes that I was a proven winner at as funding for shot taking and like funding for being able to play. Like I kind of viewed the playing 1K sit and goes as like something I wanted to do, like something to spend my money on. I mean, I was hoping I was winning at them and I was trying to, but like, yeah, I really wanted to do that. And then a little bit later, what I really wanted to do was play, you know, 10K buy-in live tournaments once I turned 21. And so I was, you know, grinding the sit and goes. Like, I remember sitting down and mapping out like, okay, if I play this many hours a month of sit and goes, then I can play this many 10Ks a year. And I was not like saving any money for myself. I was like, this is, you know, I'm going to spend it all on 10Ks and maybe I'll win one.
Think about that statement for a minute. And to those watching or listening, right? Your goal, your goal was, when I'm 21, I want to be playing in $10,000 buy-in poker tournaments.
Yeah.
Think about that for a minute. That's amazing. So it's like, so you basically, it sounds like you set up all your strategy online to be able to make enough money to go take a shot in a live tournament. Is that a fair statement?
It is, but I mean, it's definitely a fair statement, but as it turned out, I mean, I didn't end up going that route. Like, I played some, but I just ended up playing, finding a better kind of, not better, but I ended up being more successful online and making that my focus.
Yeah.
But that was definitely like poker on TV and kind of the excitement of playing big, playing against some of the best, and the excitement of, you know, the potential glory of, you know, winning a televised event. That was definitely a big pull for me. And I just like, that was the motivation to grind up the money. Because when you're 19, 20, and all of your friends are broke, like, there's nothing to spend my money on. Like the only difference in my lifestyle compared to my friends at that point is that like I would eat dinner out and or like order food whenever I wanted. And that was the only difference. Yeah. I didn't spend money on it. Or like when I was out of clean clothes, I'd go buy more clothes.
Screw laundry. I'm just going to go down to the store and get some more. Where were you at this time? Like, where were you living right at this time when you were just starting to grind online and getting some success?
In Madison, Wisconsin. So I was at college and happened to in that year I lived directly across the street from a Gap. So every time I was out of underwear, shirts, I just walked on over.
I could just picture you being like looking at this pile of laundry and just saying, "Oh, yeah. Fuck that."
Yeah. Over
here. Yep. So when you were grinding these online streets back then, right? Like, did you ever have thoughts in your mind about doing something different? Like either some type of entrepreneurial business venture, or was like poker your business? This is what you were doing and you were just going to focus all in on that for the next few years.
It was just poker. I didn't have any dreams of entrepreneurship at all. Okay. Entrepreneurship. Yeah, no.
Got it. Okay. So then, all right, walk me through the next few years, right? So you're 21, you're trying to play as much as you can online. Mm-hmm. You're trying to get in some live tournaments, but obviously like everybody pretty much knows you found some unbelievable success online, right?
Yeah.
So walk me through the next few years.
It was so when I turned 21, that was right around the time that I switched from sit and goes to cash games. So I was it's kind of a regular in the $100 through $1,000 sit and goes. And I, at the kind of advice, on the advice of my friend, Peter Jetton, who had done the same thing already, he'd moved from sit and goes to cash games. I went and started playing cash games and it's funny, actually. I never played like small stakes cash games. I went there. I started playing 5/10.
Okay, got it. So, I'm still trying to play 5/10 consistently live.
So a lot of times, people like over the years, people have asked me, you know, about like the journey grinding up and like what I thought about different stakes. And I was like, I never played like I played grinded up sit and goes, but then I just played 5/10, and that was as low as I played. Yeah. In cash games. So I was obviously fortunate the games were really good. So I went to 5/10 with, you know, kind of an early level sit and go strategy, which like in the early rounds of sit and goes, you just are a nit basically at the time. And so I just played really tight and c-bet a lot. And I think that was good enough to be a small winner in the 5/10 games at that point in time. And obviously, you know, I thought through situations. I tried to figure things out, but it was definitely, you know, I was not a very advanced player at that point. Although sit and goes, I feel like I was, but I was not an advanced post flop player by any means. So I played 5/10 and I was there for kind of a long time. So that was around like January of what year is that?
You said you were good at math and science, didn't you? Was it right after the poker boom?
No, it's 2006, I think.
Okay, so a couple years after the poker boom.
And so that January I started playing. I actually got coaching from Tommy Angelo at that point, which I thought was going to teach me how to play cash games, but his coaching was non-strategic. It was just how to be a professional poker player.
Yeah.
And so it was like a lot of things that I wasn't looking to learn, but I'm glad that I did. Mm-hmm. I started playing 5/10 cash. And then that summer was my first summer in Vegas. So I was 21 and, rented a house with a handful of guys. And I think that was the biggest jump in my game because it was the first time that I'd watched somebody else, who's another good player, play poker online and be like, "Hey, why did you do that?" Like I never would have thought to do that. Mm-hmm. And a lot of discussions that come from that. And, I think that was, just the biggest, huge, huge boost in my game. And it's funny, it was like a house that crew has done very well in poker, who at the time was, you know, high stakes sit and go, like, you know, mid high stakes sit and go players that move to mid high stakes cash game players. But a lot of them are around.
Tell me about that crew.
Huge. Yeah. So is Andrew Roble.
Yes.
Done well for himself. Peter Jetton, I previously mentioned. There's Max Greenwood, who's not playing as much poker these days, but his brothers are, Sam and Luke Greenwood. Mm-hmm. There was Dan Quinn, who's not playing poker anymore, but is my business partner at Run It Once. And Alan Sass, who also is, I don't think he plays much anymore, but he did quite well for quite a while. And then kind of in the kind of offshoot of that crew, like our good friends were, you know, Dave Benefield, mm-hmm. and Tom Dwan. Mm-hmm. I mean, a handful of others, but yeah, like it's a lot of people that, yeah, back in 2006 that really, you know, in almost 2020 has done pretty well.
It's hard to believe time has flown by that fast.
Yeah.
Like, doesn't 2006 seem like yesterday, right?
It really does. And I think of myself at that age and like, yeah, it was a while ago, but I felt, you know, I was a grown up and I don't know. I don't think of myself as old as I am. So,
yeah,
you know, it goes by really fast. And, so that summer I was playing some World Series events, didn't do very well. I was playing 5-10 in between. And then, I took some shots. It was actually a pretty memorable summer because I ended up taking some shots at 25, 50 and 5,100.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a kind of my most memorable session of all time most memorable hand. So I played this session. Basically, I ended up losing half my bankroll that summer.
God.
And a big portion of it was at 5,100 against this player who's not a good player.
Okay.
For some of my diehard fans, they've heard this story before, but it's a good one. So,
tell it because, you know, a lot of people watching this are also tuning in to hear the business story, right? So they might not know this particular story. So let's go through it. Let's take a few minutes. I mean, if you lose half your damn bankroll, there's a story, right?
Yeah.
Especially if it's one hand.
Yeah. So it was, I had been playing this guy at 5,100, was down probably, I don't know if it was 30,000 by the time this hand came up. I was in big blind with King Queen offsuit. He raised to, I think he raised to 300. Yeah. And I made it, I still remember as doing the type in sizing, I made it 1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1. Yeah. He calls. The flop is, 5-4 deuce. With a flush draw. It was something very close to that. I think that might've been it. Might've been 6-4 deuce. Anyways, I bet 1-1-1-1. He calls and, the turn pairs the 4.
Okay.
So there's now, 44, 4-4-4-4 in the pot. And we have about 9,000 in stacks, 8,000 in stacks. So, you know, less than 2x pot. I don't have a good hand or a good draw. I decide to check. And he pretty quickly pots for a 4-4-4-4. And they didn't have time banks at this time. Like, you just had your time to act. So I was sitting there and I was just like, man, I really don't, this doesn't make any sense. I don't think he's betting like this with like a 5 when the 4 pairs or a deuce. Like, how often does he have a 4? I just don't think he has it, but, you know, I'm down a bunch of money. Do I really want to, like, what am I going to do about it? Do I really want to risk another 8,000 hoping that he doesn't have it in a spot where, like, I have nothing, I have no pair, no draw. And I sound tanking. But it's like, I don't know what it is, 30 seconds. And I get down to the very end of my time bank and I was like, I just don't believe him, all in. And so I go all in and he starts tanking.
Oh, wow. You got to feel good now. You're like, oh, yeah. God, right?
Yeah. But I'm also like, man, so what's he tanking with? Maybe he has like ace high and I'm going to make him fold, which would be great. Maybe he does have like a 5 and now he just thinks I have an overpair and is maybe going to fold it. Because I thought if he was bluffing, you know, with like, let's say queen 6, he's just going to fold. Because obviously, like, he just snap fold. So I was like, okay, please fold, please fold, please fold. He's tanking all the way down. At the last second, he calls.
Mm.
And my heart drops. Mm-hmm. The cards flip over. He has king jack for a worse no pair, no draw. Before I could like process that, River Jack.
Oh, come on, man. Really?
And he gets there. And then that end of my session and my very poor summer.
And you know what? Like, it's like, there are no words for that. Unless you've gone through something like that, whether it's that amount of money or, you know, what is a lot amount of money for somebody else, like that feeling of emptiness, knowing you made all the right decisions. And then for that to happen, it's just like the biggest punch in the gut. I couldn't imagine it, you know, from your perspective with that amount of money on the line. So have you ever like bet 1-1-1-1 again? Or are you like staying away from that forever?
I think I stuck with it for a while. Yeah. Although I wasn't playing 5,100 for a little while. So it was the, maybe the 1-1-1 at 5-10.
So for folks who have experienced that type of situation, right? Like, how do you bounce back from it? What advice would you tell them to bounce back from it? Whether it's poker or, you know, business or anything, when you get that type of punch in the gut.
Man, it's tough. I do think that there's a lot to be said for, you know, bankroll management, whether it's, which is not what I was practicing at this time, but if I'm advising people, you know, bankroll management, whether it's or risk reduction, whether, you know, if it's in business or poker, kind of not having all your eggs in one basket, which I guess I still don't really practice. But I think there's a lot to be said for that. I think there's also, you know, and this, the thing is, this isn't going to apply to everybody, but for me, you know, I was 21 with a good ability to earn a good living at 5'10" with, you know, enough money to support myself for a while because I had like no expenses. So what it always was for me was, and sometimes it usually took one night of sleep. And I kind of just stay sad the rest of the day. And the next day I wake up and realize, you know what, life is pretty good. And it's so much for me every time that happens is detaching from like basically reframing your life from that point forward rather than where you were the day before. And it's just like, yes, of course I know that life was better yesterday and I had a lot more money. Maybe I was closer to my dreams of moving up to 2550 and 5100, but you know what? That's over. That's done. Starting from today, you know, this is how much money I have left. This is my life. My life's pretty good. You know, here's my next goal. Here's what I want to work towards. And that's always been really helpful for me. I've in almost all cases been able to, in a day, kind of shake it off.
Goal setting is so important for me too, after some type of failure, right? Whether it's like a poker tournament, I really had high hopes of going deeper in, or a type of cash game like that, or just business, right? When you have a setback, I kind of handle it the same way, where it's process it, feel it, then let it go, recenter yourself, look at the big picture, and just what's your next goal? Because otherwise, if you just dwell on that failure, you're never going to experience growth. You're just going to stay stagnant, right?
And it's so easy to dwell on the failure. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of our, you know, it's our nature to, like, anytime you catch yourself with like your main feeling or thought being, oh, I wish that didn't happen. You know, you're kind of stuck. And until you can stop having that feeling and get that out of your mind, you're not going to move past it. It's just, but like for a long time there, in some of those cases, it's hard to shake that feeling. And even in some of these cases where I feel, say like the next day I shook it, I would still have that feeling, or like, you know, you get pangs of that from time to time. I still remember there was a World Series event where, I mean, we're skipping ahead now, but it's just a quick story. There's a World Series event where I got heads up, a really big one too. It was 25K, no limit, six max tournament, relatively early in my career. And I got heads up and I lost. And there was one hand actually very similar to that one where I had the opportunity to go all in on the turn with no pair, no draw, nothing at all. No chance of being good. Like I had a 10 high or something, but I was just like, I really think this is the right play. I really think it is. And I just didn't pull the trigger. And it would have worked. And it would have given me a big chip lead, and who knows what would have happened. And that, you know, I didn't dwell on it like in a constant state of dwelling for a long time. But I mean, for the next for the next while. You know, every once in a while, it's like, wish I did that.
Yeah. And it's kind of like, then you have double pain. Yeah. Cause you're like upset at yourself for not following your gut, right? Yeah. Or your head, really. Yeah. And then it's like, then it's causing you to think back to that time when you lost the big hand, King, Jack, King, Queen. And it's like, why did I let that scare me or something like that? Right. So it's almost like a double punch to the gut, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And a lot of people, I mean, that's another thing actually where I think a lot of people say, you know, nice problem to have getting second in a 25K WSOP event. But actually, like, that's one of my biggest regrets in my career. And it is, you know, for people who are really competitive and who, like, you know, my first goal was like, play these huge tournaments and win. That's sometimes the hardest thing is getting close and coming up short.
But that's what happens, right? I mean, you set your goals that high.
Yeah.
Like that high that it's going to be a very small part of the time that you actually achieve it. And even if you get close to achieving it, which would be a tremendous goal for someone else, because your expectations of yourself are that high, you're going to feel like some failure, but really it isn't failure. You're just like beating yourself up a little bit about it. Right. Yeah. But I mean, that's what happens. Like that's the gift and curse of high goal setting.
Yeah.
Like, rarely do you hit those goals.
Yep. I was having a conversation with a friend of mine recently, and I was talking about how I wish that, so like in any given day, I'm never going to get done as much as I could, or like there are more things that I could do that would benefit me as a poker player or benefit the business. They're just, I'm never going to get through the list of all the things I want to do. And so I was telling him that I wish that I could release myself like from that hanging over my head from that stress, because then I end my workday and I go hang out with my family and I still am stressed. I still have that hanging over my head. And I know that I'm not being my most present and best self. Mm-hmm. And what he pointed out, which, you know, well, it is maybe an obvious observation and I don't know if there's anything you can do to change it, but like, that's kind of what comes along with being very ambitious and having high goals, and like that's just part of the personality type that very badly wants to do great things and you know tries very hard to. And I don't know in your experience, because I know you have a similar personality. I don't know if there's got to be a way to decouple that, but it's I don't know how.
It's called Welcome to Dad Life.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where you never feel like you're doing that as well as you could, or you never feel like you're doing your other babies, right?
Yeah.
Your businesses as well as you could. It's a constant state of, man, am I as present as I need to be here, as present as I need to be there? But it's like just the fact you question it, and just the fact you try to be the best dad in the moment or the best business person in the moment, like that makes you great at both. Right. It can make you great at both.
It can. So, yeah.
It can. You know, the constant mindfulness of making sure that you're as good as you can in both those areas.
Yeah.
So, but I haven't figured it out. If you do, you know, holler at me. We'll do a whole other podcast. Or apparently this is called a vodcast because a big portion of it is video.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Which I just read this morning. Been calling it the wrong thing. So anyway, all right. So let's go from like 2006, like the next 3 or 4 years after that. Right. So you had your crew in Vegas. You're obviously very prominent now in the online world. You're getting live experience. You're getting results. Now what happens from that time, like the mid 2000s to, you know, once we get to the 2010s and et cetera.
Yeah. So after that setback, I actually don't know the exact, I think I kind of did some similar things, rebuild, take a shot. But by the next summer, I know that by that time I was playing in the big games on Full Tilt, like 100, 200, 200, 400, no limit. So at some point, one of those shots stuck. I actually don't even remember which one it was or the specific details. But I did go from that, you know, from my, bankroll. Of my bankroll disaster to turning it around with a lot of hard work and probably some luck. So I at that point, you know, there were still a lot of swings because I was always playing underrolled, but at that point I was kind of a nosebleed player from then on. I think my first experience, or I know my first experience with poker training, I'd already watched poker training videos on Card Runners. I think on Deuces Cracked, or although at that time, maybe there was only Card Runners. But anyways, or at least that was like the main one that I watched. Taylor, Green Plastic, of Card Runners, sat down with me, had dinner with me, and said, you know, would you want to make some videos for Card Runners? And I'd always been interested in sharing strategy, kind of. I thought it was something I could do a good job of. And, you know, if you do a good job of something, it, you know, makes you feel good about yourself. So I always kind of wanted to share strategy. I remember trying to write some articles, and at some points I did write some articles, strategy articles. I think the first time I wanted to write strategy articles for 2+2 magazine, which is just like an online thing.
Yeah.
And this was a long time ago, like before we're stepping backwards now, but I reached out and asked, you know, if they'd be interested in an article, and, you know, like, I don't know if I asked what they would pay, or like, I just want to know if they would publish an article. And they were like, well, we need to see a sample. So if you'd write an article and send it in, I was like, oh, I don't feel like doing that.
So. But now we go back to the high school stories. You know, yeah.
If I had a guaranteed spot for the article, I'd write it, but yeah. I don't want to write it just to be rejected. So I didn't do it. Anyways, though, Card Runners, I basically said, you know, why don't you make a video, like a test video, and see how the community reacts, and then we could talk about, you know, working out a deal. And so I made a test video, and it was actually really well received. So I did a single video for Card Runners. We ended up not working out a deal. It just didn't make sense to me or to both parties, whatever it was. But that one video was kind of my first taste of, you know, sharing strategy and people, you know, complimenting me on my advice and you know, strategy discussion. And I actually, like, I was hooked, but I didn't do anything about it. Mm-hmm. Because I think it didn't make a lot of sense. I was playing super high stakes. It wasn't so much that I was worried about people using, I mean, I was slightly worried about people using my strategy against me, or finding holes in my games through it. But it was also just hard to make it financially viable. Like, mm-hmm. even if I enjoyed the process, how do I justify to myself, like, when I'm playing 300, 600, no limit, making a strategy video for whatever, you know, a small fraction of like an hourly rate, even mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. a small fraction of an hourly rate. And then also sharing, you know, letting the world see how I play. Mm-hmm. So it just didn't make sense. And it wasn't until later when actually at the same time got approached by two different people starting a poker training business, asking me to partner in some way, and spoke with both of them and liked one of their pitches more. And then started, that was Blue Fire Poker, mm-hmm. which I made strategy videos for a long time. I don't know how long, several years. And
was this your first business kind of venture outside of poker? Or
yeah, but not really. It wasn't my business.
Yeah.
I mean, I was, you know, I was whatever, team member number two.
Yeah, got it. You were a content creator, right?
Yeah. And I certainly cared about the business, and yeah, like you could say that it was, but it wasn't exactly the same thing. And we ended up having different, I don't know how to put it, like nobody did anything wrong, but we were miscommunicating a lot, and basically the deal that we both agreed to ended up not being, I felt, not a good one for me. Mm-hmm. But not because I was like, not because I understood the terms, but I kind of expected different things from him and from the business than mm-hmm. that actually happened. In short, I was expecting to be a small part of a big team. And I instead was a big part of a small team.
Got it.
And so like I was carrying a lot of the weight myself. We ended up, you know, having a falling out of sorts. And
it's really important that in kind of like a partnership like that, right, that expectations are known up front.
Yep.
To me, like from what it's
it was such a valuable lesson. Yeah.
Yeah. And that like visions are the same.
Yeah.
Right. Or if even if visions are different, if each person can kind of bring to life their own vision, but it plays into the bigger vision of the entire company, that's important too. So what would you tell people who are like thinking about entering a business kind of partnership type deal and they're on the fence of what to do? What would you tell them to think about?
Man, I mean, so I still, you know, have limited business experience, but I've been doing it for a little while now and it's so tough. And I've seen other people get into business. I've seen other people have problems. It's so tough to, like they say, you know, don't mix business with pleasure, but I feel like unless you've known somebody a long time and you're not going to know, like you're not really going to know who they are, how they're going to handle themselves when times are tough, how you guys are going to handle disagreements. So like I'm personally very inclined to only, if I were to start a business again, to only start businesses with friends.
Yeah.
But obviously there's some risks there too, in terms of like potentially damaging a friendship. So like, I don't know. I would just say people that you know very well and that you know, I mean, I don't want to necessarily say are very reasonable people because that's assuming that I'm a very reasonable person, but see eye to eye with me. Because you can't predict all of the things that are going to happen down the road. And while it's super important to make your expectations clear up front, which we didn't do a good job of, we were both young. It's super important to make expectations clear up front, but even if you do that very well, there are going to be unforeseen circumstances that arise. And at that point, if you're not seeing eye to eye, it can be, you know, it can be disastrous for the business.
Yeah. And you got to have those direct conversations and check yourself. And it sounds like you made the decision that was best for you, which in life, sometimes you have to do. Sometimes it's not selfish to look out for number one sometimes, right? Especially if you're not screwing anybody over. It's just sometimes you got to look out for yourself and what's best for your future if you're in a bad spot. And it's okay to have those direct conversations. So, all right. So did this kind of light the fire under you to say, hey, look, why can't I just do this on my own? And the second part of that is, when did you kind of overcome that mindset of, yeah, but is this like plus EV in terms of time and money compared to playing? Because I imagine you had to weigh that a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, so it definitely did light the fire because, I mean, the way that it kind of ended, or the reason it ended was like, I didn't like the deal that I agreed to through no fault of his. Because we had different expectations. And so I felt I was worth a lot more to the business than I was, you know, being compensated for. And he didn't agree, and that's his right. But I also kind of wanted to prove to myself that I was, that you know, I can, like, I have a lot of value to bring to a training site, both in terms of as a content creator, as a recruiter, and, you know, understanding what the players want and like business strategy. And so I wanted to prove that more to myself than anybody else. And I really felt like I could do it. So I actually ended up talking to Dan Quinn, who I mentioned earlier, a longtime friend ever since. I mean, before we met in Vegas, we were, you know, 2+2 friends, instant messenger friends. From the sit and go days, and we'd always been friends. Oh, I mean, we became very good friends because it was that summer in Vegas when I was 21. He, coincidentally, like we didn't even know this going into the summer, but we lived in the same house. And then coincidentally, he was moving to Madison, Wisconsin right after summer because his girlfriend, now wife, lived there. And so we ended up, I mean, not like being neighbors, but being in the same city and spending a lot of time together, became very good friends. And he and I actually, this was before any of the other businesses, we had the idea of starting a training business back then. but basically decided like we both were doing too well playing poker and it just didn't make sense. Mm-hmm. But we saw eye to eye on a lot of things. We had similar kind of visions for it, kind of passion for getting the product right. And I don't know, we saw eye to eye in a lot of ways, and he, is he had a job before poker. He's like, you know, a real person who,
He's a real person. He actually had a job. He kind of has some experience. Right.
Yeah. I get it. So like, he's definitely somebody who I trusted to handle more of the business side of things. So when we started Run at Once, training, he actually quit poker, to do that full time.
Oh, wow. What a commitment.
Yeah. And so he was just running the business. And I still, you know, played a lot of poker. I was, you know, the face of the site and made videos and helped hire. Like, he was actually like one of the, I think the biggest advantages for Run at Once is that he's just an awesome, awesome recruiter of coaches, because he would like deep dive research, like every player on every site, any data he can get access to, and be like, okay, this guy's an excellent player. This guy's an excellent player. And we just cold contact people. Like, most training sites have been, you know, like waited for people to be well known and then talk to them, or they wait for people to like apply. It's like, mm-hmm. Hey, I'm interested in making videos. But he just went out and found people that nobody had heard of, like nobody. And like a lot of people said, like, how did you hear of me, or how did you find me? He's like, well, this
Dan's kind of a stalker. That's how we found you, in a great way. Yeah.
He would be an excellent stalker if you wanted. but so he would find people and then, talk to them. They submit a video demo and I would watch it and, you know, approve or reject it. And we'd make them an offer. And that's how we built our team for the most part.
Wow.
And so it began. And so I would say, like, I was a part of every single big decision at Run at Once Training, and like even more than that, but I was not doing the day-to-day business. It was still like, I was not doing any kind of managing of people. He did all of that. Mm-hmm. So it was, you know, a little bit more of a taste of business, but not everything.
Okay. Got it.
And Run at Once, I mean, within the first year of launching, became the number one training site. And it was kind of like, we came in really at a good time. I mean, I think we came in with an excellent product.
2012?
Yeah.
Yeah, 2012.
It was the end of December 2012. Okay. And we basically, like, we both felt that the training sites out there were, I mean, they were kind of disorganized. They would release some video, some weeks they would release two videos, some weeks they'd release five. There was no like set schedule. And you know, they had a lot of like filler content, mm-hmm. A couple of good pros. But actually, like, our timing was good because like Card Runners, Deuces Cracked had signed all of, you know, these super popular pros who many of them at that point were like not playing as much, mm-hmm. Or had, you know, like they had like all these stars that were becoming, that many of whom were becoming kind of less of stars. And so they were kind of tied to those people. So we had an opportunity, a great opportunity in terms of timing. Like, if we had launched 3 years prior, I think there would have been a lot tougher. There would have mm-hmm. been a lot tougher competition. We pretty quickly became number one training site. Oh, so we also, a big part of our approach is like, we want to, a slicker, more professional website. We want to release consistent videos. We've released two videos every day since launch, since 2012.
So amazing to me. And I saw over 125 instructors. Is that right?
Probably not active, but that could be in terms of like, we've always had, and we charge more. Every site was charging like, $25 to $35 a month. Mm-hmm. And we came out and for our elite package charged $100, because we were getting, first of all, I mean, there's way more content, but second of all, we were getting top guys. Yeah. And that was our approach. Like, you know what, there needs to be a better training product. And in order to do that, we're gonna have to charge more to pay these coaches, you know, what we need to. But we're also going to, you know, make the experience, more of a first-class experience, slick website, treat customers well, treat the coaches well. And, and just have a really, really strong product. That was our, both of our passion have always, passions have always been for the product.
Very similar to kind of how we approach launching Faded Spade, like extremely similar approach. Okay. So I want to back up a little bit. So when Black Friday happened, did that cause any shift in your mindset to get more into other things like this versus the online grind or no?
It didn't. Actually, so after Black Friday, I ended up moving to Vancouver to play.
That's right. Okay.
And I'd also recently gotten out of a relationship. Mm-hmm. And so like I really dove into poker, and it was the first time, like it was first time in a little while that I had my full focus on poker. And also the first time in a while that I moved in with a couple of friends. One of whom, mainly one who stayed there, who's a serious poker player. And it was the first time in a while I'd done that. And like, that was probably soon after Black, like within the first 2 years, I think was probably me at the peak of my game compared to the competition. Like that was when I was at my best. As a player, not like I'm better now than I was then, but the competition is, you guys.
Isn't it amazing how competition has just come up so quick because of poker training site availability, right? But at the same time, like what a lucrative market.
Yeah. I mean, it's a lot of things. It's poker training sites. It's also just, I mean, software advances, of course. Mm-hmm. And it's really just, you know, like poker was very young. As far as like before online poker, it wasn't studied like in a group. I guess the internet sped up a lot of things. Mm-hmm. Just like we learned all as a community, even before, like even outside of training sites, just on forums and people like had tools and started learning how to play better. And then we would see them play because they were playing against us and we'd be like, why is he doing this? Oh, okay. Let's, you know,
got
run some amateur math and see if we can figure it out.
Yeah.
And those, the tools keep progressing and the game keeps progressing.
Yeah. So when did New York happen? And what is this? I read about some slide from one apartment to the other. So what time frame from was that? Was that in between all this or?
That was. So like that, I left New York after Black Friday. So
got it. Okay.
It was Black Friday was 2011. So then New York was like, I think early 2008.
Okay.
Or maybe end of 2007 or early 2008, I think that I moved there.
Got it.
And yeah, it was, it was one apartment, but I was actually, I bought two apartments, or condos and combined them. And, because there was a building that I really liked, but the only units they had were smaller than I wanted. And so my real estate agent was like, well, here's something you could do. All right. That sounds good. And I did. So as I was working with architects to figure out what to do. Actually, it was the first time I saw the units. Mm-hmm. I don't know why I said it because it was kind of as a joke. I was there with my friend who was going to be my roommate. I was just like, okay, so we'll have to knock down, you know, like somewhere in the ceiling, put some stairs. And I was like, oh, we should probably put a slide. and then I ended up liking the idea. It was no more expensive than a staircase. But much cooler.
Did you actually use it a lot?
No, not a lot because I would have, but it was really fast. It was a pretty steep and slick slide. I had always intended to like put some like wax on it or something to slow it down, but never did. And so it was like, you had to be kind of ready to make an athletic landing. And so first the time to use it is, you know, upstairs are the bedrooms, downstairs, everything else. So like, first thing in the morning, you slide downstairs, but you're not ready before your coffee to stick the landing.
did you love New York? Did you like New York?
You know, I moved to New York. This was from Madison, Wisconsin. I would have stayed in Madison, Wisconsin. I absolutely loved it there. Yeah. But you know, I had dropped out of college, but my friends were graduating.
Yeah.
And I had a lot of friends leaving. And New York is where some of my best friends went, and where one of my best friends was going. So we both moved at the same time, kind of agreed on it together. I like New York. I don't really like any place the way that a lot of people can. I stay at home and I don't care that much. Mm-hmm. So I liked it, but I mostly liked it for my friends.
Yeah.
Yeah, to see them live that city lifestyle. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Got it. So, okay. So Wisconsin, Las Vegas, New York, Vancouver, all of a sudden you're starting Run It Once. It's in the year, it becomes the biggest training site. You're dabbling into business, even though, you know, you were mentioning you're not doing all the employee management and stuff yet, but you're the face of the company. You're trying to help achieve this vision, right? So what were the first few years of Run It Once like, and when did you start getting this idea for Run It Once Poker in terms of extending the brand from training to online poker?
So that was a lot there. It was a lot. Yeah. It was pretty smooth sailing for the first while at Run It Once training. We pretty quickly started taking on other, we were always ambitious. Mm-hmm. And so we've actually, we've launched another business that didn't succeed. We tried to launch another business that didn't succeed. So like I never was making money from Run It Once Poker. We were spending it on trying to grow.
That's right. We talked about this at lunch. Okay. Yeah. So tell everybody about those two businesses as you were growing Run It Once training and then trying to get into other businesses.
Yeah. So one was a software project, which I'll leave it at that for now. It's basically dead, but it's not 100%. It's like 99.9% dead.
Okay.
But it was a software project that was a joint venture with a developer, and we ended up being really slow, and like we were tasked with design, which we're pretty good at, but it was pretty complex. And we ended up hiring an outside, you know, design firm, and it took a long time. So like we were slow to start, and the development was taking a really long time. And it ended up just taking forever. And eventually we stopped hearing back from the developer. And so the project just kind of died. It was very expensive for us, but it was a learning experience, I guess we can say. And then we launched DraftBoard in 2018, or I don't know. I think early 2018, I want to say. I could be wrong about the timeline. That was a daily fantasy sports site. And that was another one that, you know, I mean, like everything took us longer than we expected. And I think actually, like DraftBoard was a beautifully designed and developed product. Like I still believe we ended up shutting the doors to it recently, like in the past few months. It's a daily fantasy sports site that you play on, like a DraftKings or a FanDuel or a Fantasy Draft. And it was a passion project for basically all of my team, except for me. I had never played daily fantasy, but they all did. They were really into it. Mm-hmm. And I really wanted to do this. And I was like, yeah, let's do it. And I still believe that it was like, I think it was definitely the best designed of all the fantasy sports sites.
Great name.
DraftBoard. Yeah. We paid for that. And thank you. We spend so much time naming products. Yeah. It's like, yeah. We spend like, I don't know if you guys did with Faded Spade, but we spend, we're actually trying to name something right now. It's ridiculous. Anyways,
not easy.
It's not. Anyways, but yeah, it was a beautifully designed product. It came out a little bit too late because like if it had come out 2 years prior, I think it would have done pretty well because the market was so good. And it was before the states started shutting it down state by state. And some started requiring a license. Some just wouldn't let you operate. And so liquidity dropped quite a bit. And, you know, DFS got less popular as a result. And then also, I think what would have helped is if we had not spent all of our money on all of these projects, including Run It Once Poker, which we had begun spending on, which was really expensive because we just had zero marketing budget. And I mean, I don't think we would have had enough anyways to really make it go. I think like you basically, because it seems that even in that industry, even like anybody but the big two are not doing that well.
Mm-hmm. Even which like, is why they're getting into sports betting.
Yeah. Yeah. But like we didn't to get into sports betting, like what they had to get into sports, which is like a great lead into sports betting, is a huge user base of people who mm-hmm. love sports and in some ways were betting on sports already. But we didn't have a big user base, so we didn't really have much to offer other than, you know, some nice, like very nice fantasy sports software, a team that had gotten pretty competent and knowledgeable with like data. What's the word I'm looking for? Basically like parsing data feeds and spitting out real-time content. One of our big features, which other sites don't have, is called the like it was called draft board live section. Mm-hmm. And you have like either a court or a field visually. Mm-hmm. You have your team on one side, your one of your opponent's teams on the other. So you could like, if you're playing a head to head, then you see their lineup and yours, you see the scores, you see each player. And then when a play happens, it would visually animate on the field. Mm-hmm. And then your points would tick up and things like that. So you could watch in real time, but like just your roster, not like watching an individual game, because it could be, you know, you have people on six different teams. And it was beautiful and really cool. Anyways, so our team got good at that. It doesn't do us any good anymore.
Well, you know what? Maybe down the road, maybe there's something there.
Yeah, you never
down
know.
The road.
But yeah, basically, I think that without... Like, I think the timing wasn't good, and I think the... well, we just didn't have a lot to spend, and I think that's kind of the only way you do it. Another thing that we were kind of hoping for, since, well, we went into this with the approach of, like, we knew that we weren't going to have a big marketing budget. Mm-hmm. And so we kind of took the opposite approach. We wanted to be something different. Mm-hmm. And you know, one thing that people were frustrated with, you know, DraftKings, FanDuel is playing in a contest and, you know, being in, you know, having like 50 spots pay and being in 40th place till the end of the day. And then 15 of the same person passes you because you can enter, you know, a million lineups, across all the contests. And so we had a single entry contest and no big prize pools. It was all like sit and goes basically. And so we did have some like big promotions where you could win a big prize, big, like $10,000, not like a million.
Right.
But it seems like we had a few users. The users we had loved it, absolutely loved the product, but it was hard without a marketing budget and without big guarantees. Like we didn't think that the guarantees didn't matter. We knew they mattered. We were hoping that there was a large enough demographic who were frustrated with those highly raked, multi-entry big tournaments where they were kind of like at a disadvantage to all the pros who are really good and entering however many times. We were hoping there were enough of those that wanted something different. And I don't know whether we were wrong or right, but it does seem like I wouldn't say we're wrong because we knew that the guarantees would matter, but I do think they definitely matter.
And here's what's so interesting. If you're for some reason starting at this point of the conversation, we're not talking about poker. we're not talking about poker. So we're talking about Draft Board, the fantasy daily software or app or business that Phil and his team were thinking about launching or did launch.
We did launch, yeah.
Yeah, did launch. So, and, wow, Phil, like, I don't think a lot of people are going to know that story, man.
Yeah, which is also kind of me failing to promote things well because I don't want to, like, be in your face as much as I probably should.
So let's dovetail.
Yeah. But anyways, yeah, so that, like, that didn't work. We could have kept it open. Like, it wasn't crazy expensive, but we're spending so much everywhere that it's like, we felt like there wasn't a reason to keep it open without a plan to grow it, because it was just going to, you know, continue to lose a little bit of money every month.
Got it.
Yeah. You know,
so, okay. So it sounds like this, correct me if I'm wrong. Mm-hmm. Run at once training, taking off. You're taking a lot of that capital you're putting into starting some new businesses, right? You're the software business you mentioned, Draft Board that you mentioned, which who knows, Phil, I'm telling you, maybe that comes back around full circle one day and it turns into something else. And it sounds like you alluded to the fact that you were starting to think about Run at Once Poker, the online poker platform around this time too, right? So
yeah, we were already like, we were working on three projects, not including Run at Once Training, at the same time for a lot of it. The software project that fell through, Draft Board, and Run at Once Poker. And so at the beginning, Run at Once Poker. So we started Run at Once Poker for a couple of reasons. It kind of was, the impetus was a friend of ours who ended up working for the company suggests the idea to us. And it was at a time when, you know, PokerStars had been purchased by Maya. They were making some changes that were kind of player unfriendly. And to me, like, led me to believe that they were headed in a pretty bad direction. This was several years ago. And I think it's kind of been proven that that was the case. Bad direction for the players, not necessarily for them as a company. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I guess kind of the same 21-year-old who was taking shots at 100, 200 as soon as he could afford to, just, you know, it sounded like a very exciting idea. Mm-hmm. And I knew the whole, like, I knew that we understood things about the game and that at least some poker sites could not as non-poker players, or even like as non-expert poker players. And I knew that we could come up with good ideas. I knew we could design a good looking product. I knew that we knew what players wanted from a UX perspective. I was like, you know what, maybe this is something we can do. And so we started, we ended up hiring this person. And for a long time, it was him and another employee that we hired, just the two of them working away at setting the company up. And it actually, like, for the beginning of the company, it didn't involve me very much. I mean, like, the logistics, and it didn't involve Dan either, just like setting up a company, getting licensed, researching places to go. Like, that was all these two. And of course, they'd come present things to us and we'd talk about things. Once we started talking about the product, that's when I was very involved. Mm-hmm. And we actually brought on our, at the time, poker room manager, Jason Sentai, who was a longtime good friend of mine, who is now has since been promoted and is actually basically running the company. And that's when, like, we would have regular meetings with Jason and the whole team, really. And we were talking about, like, yeah, you know, what are the policies of this poker room going to be? What are we, you know, start rake, like, what are our rake philosophies, things like that. And then, of course, we started with, so we actually, so unfortunately, the developer who was working on that other project that fell through began, like, took the lead on this project at the beginning. And up until that point, I had a ton of faith in him, and he, like, had proven that he could do things very well. He had, like, anyways, he was I guess CTO, and started building a team around him, a small team at that time. And, I mean, too long of a story, you know, to short, medium, we got, like, the software got to a point where, so the team had been estimating that we'd launch something in, I want to say, what's it, 29th, like 2017. Mm-hmm. And early 2017. Mm-hmm. And that's what we were planning on. And that obviously didn't happen.
Right.
And actually, it was around that time that developer said, like, he couldn't handle both projects.
Right.
And so he quit Runner One's Poker to just focus on the other one.
Right.
Which I think, you know, was the right move and for everybody.
Right.
And I actually, once again, I think one of the big challenges there was miscommunication. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, we were kind of asking him, you know, how long is it going to take from this point to build a poker site And at the time that he started working on it, laying the groundwork, we hadn't come up with our policies and features, many of which were pretty unique.
Right.
And he didn't know how picky we were going to be with UX. He didn't know how picky we were going to be with design. And so, you know, would he have delivered a product that worked technically? He very well might have in the timeline that he expected. But once we started submitting all the specs and things like that, it was just, you know,
it's too much, right?
It was too much. It was much bigger than he than he anticipated. And that's really, that's not his fault. I mean, it's more our fault than his, but it's just lack of communication.
Yeah. And that's going to happen, right? In business, there are going to be there's going to be times of lack of communication, but imagine if you would have launched a product that you weren't completely satisfied with, or at least really, really, really satisfied with, because you only get one time to launch the first time, right?
Well, yeah. But to be fair, we launched a product that I was not at all completely satisfied with back in
February. I remember we talked about this. I remember we talked about it, but
it was kind of a, well, I don't know. Anyways, from that point, it was, you know, we went through a couple of different, tech leadership changes before settling on the team we have today. Or, I mean, it's constantly changing, but the technical director that we have today, who's done a fantastic job and, has really gotten us in the right direction and to a point where the software is something that we, you know, can build upon to get all the things we want in there and like is working really nicely right now and looks good and feels good.
Yeah. I hear and see and read great feedback. Right. And I know you're going to be your harshest critic.
Yes.
Right. Like we talked about, you're going to be right. Yeah. And it's like, you can never wait for it to be perfect or else it'll never launch. Right.
Yeah.
But it's like, I think people have the understanding that this is going to be a work in progress. I think you came out with a really great product. Is it exactly where you want it to be? No, but it's like, that's almost the journey.
Yeah.
Is everything you got to do to make it what you want it to be. And it might not ever get there, but it's like, we go back to that big goal setting you were talking about. Your goals are so high for it that even if you don't meet your own personal goals and professional goals, it's probably going to exceed the expectations of folks who are on it.
Yeah.
Or at least the hope, right?
And I mean like, yeah. And I mean, I will not be satisfied until it's like very clearly the best poker software. Mm-hmm. And that's quite an ambitious goal with a team of our size when, you know, I don't know, PokerStars has 1,000 developers or whatever they have and Party Poker has however many hundred. And, so it's definitely an ambitious goal. But I do think we're getting closer and closer to it. And we are running into kind of a similar problem that we have with DraftBoard, which is we don't have a lot of money to market it. Mm-hmm. We have, you know, we have like a group of users who really love us and love the product, but they're, you know, too small of a group. Mm-hmm. And so right now, I mean, we're always like, development has always been, for a long time, development was just like all we were focused on because we had to get to launch. But we've always focused on it. We're always building and improving the software. But now our biggest challenge is growth.
Yeah, right.
And as you know, we've talked about, like, you, unfortunately for us, you know, a big part of the quality of your product is how many players are playing on it. And in order to get more players playing on it, you need that product, which is based on that liquidity, to be better. So you need players to get players. We have some. So taking it back to February, we launched in February. Had a really great launch month traffic wise. Like the first week, it was fantastic. A lot of people had been really excited about it, hopped on, tried it out, were playing. But we, and I've discussed this somewhere, I think in some of my posts on runatonce.eu. But we had from that point, like a few pretty big bugs, and we launched in beta. We're actually technically still in beta. But we had a few, you know, reasonable size bugs that really hurt the experience. We did not get fixes out fast enough. It for a number of reasons, which I went into, it took a long time. And over those many months, we kind of steadily lost players. And I want to say May, although I could find out quickly, but around then we launched, we updated the software, with an update that fixed the majority of the major issues. And we've continued to update, every so often. I don't know if it's every month and a half or something on average. We're aiming for more frequently than that, but you know how it goes. It's gotten better and better. And since you know, after summer, like the end of summer, we've actually been growing again, not very fast.
Great.
But we have been growing again.
Great.
But we need to figure out, our biggest challenge now is figuring out how to grow faster, because, like I said, we need players to get players. I do think it's like, it is kind of a, you know, an exponential growth kind of thing where the more players you have, the better your product is, the more players check it out, the more players stick, and so on and so forth. And so like, if we can really get a push to get to that, whatever that critical mass is that makes a big difference, I think it'd be great. And well, obviously it'd be great, but in the meantime, we're still, you know, burning a lot of money every month because
right.
a big team and we're giving a lot of money back through promotions. And, but even if we weren't, like we just, our expenses are very, very high. It's hard. It's a big business.
Yeah. So it's almost like you're at that point and it's all right. You're happy with the software, right? Development is going to be a constant growth channel, but it's like, how do we get butts in seats?
Yeah.
Right. Or like at the hotel and resort world, how do you get heads in beds?
Yeah.
Right. So it's kind of like, okay, it sounds like 2020. Yeah, all right. Yeah. What is Phil Run at Once going to do now to help reach that tipping point? And I'm looking forward to see, you know, what you're going to do. I know we've talked about this before. So.
Yeah, I am too. I'm looking forward to it too.
Yeah. And I have all the confidence in the world in you. And I know the poker community does too.
Thank you.
And the thing is, and this is a good, I think, point for a lot of people who are on their dirt journey with their business. Like you have had your hands in a lot of different pots, right? Trying to grow this business, that business, build this business. You're trying to juggle in your team, not just building the best, you know, online poker software out there, a great brand, et cetera. You know, you've had a lot of different focuses, but you've figured out that right now you've got to do X.
Yeah.
And you can pour your attention into that, you know, and do what you got to do to keep balancing the other things, but pour your attention into that. And I think there comes a point in time in a lot of people's journeys where as an entrepreneur, you're trying to do so many things, but when you find out like, this is what I've got to do, or this is what we've got to do, you just have to pour your heart and soul into it and make it happen. Right.
Yeah. Yeah,
so is that what you're kind of intending on doing right now?
Yeah. Mostly. So we definitely had, I think it's somewhat common, but we tried to do too many things at once and they all kind of happened to us sort of. Well, not like, obviously we chose to do them, but like things just came along, opportunities came along, ideas came along and we're like, that's a good idea. We should do that. Or this is a good opportunity. We should take that. But we ended up, you know, splitting our focus too much and it all, you know, if everything had been developed quickly, which none of it was, and they've been successful, so we had been making money that we could spend to grow the other products, it would have been great. But you know, anytime you spread yourself too thin and then things don't go well, it's really hard to claw back because our resources are spread everywhere.
Right.
You know, we can't pour, like we just don't have the resources to pour, whether it's you know, financial resources or manpower and focus of our leaders. It's just, it's everywhere. So that was, you know, probably a mistake that we made, although I think each of the things individually very well could have worked out if some things changed. But
you have to avoid the jack on the river, man. Sometimes you got to avoid the jack on the river.
Exactly. Well, you have to be prepared for the jack on the river. Mm-hmm. What happens next?
Right.
And so we did hit a lot of bad breaks, but potentially predictable ones, you know, development delays, you know, market conditions changing, personnel problems or people losing motivation or, I mean, just stuff happens. And I think like going from Run at Once training, which was kind of just a small group of friends to a very big business. You can just a lot more, there are just so many more variables and so many more things that can go wrong.
Yeah. And now you're a much bigger part of operating the business, right? The things that you might not have been doing with Run at Once training, you're doing now with Run at Once poker. Never mind the fact, right? So let's talk about this. I know we're kind of coming to the end of our time and whatnot, but you know, never mind the fact in your personal life, right?
Yeah.
You have
became a dad.
You get married, you become a dad and all that. So talk to me about that, right? So I know Farah is a huge part of your life. I know she's a huge part of support and involved with Run at Once training, Run at Once poker, et cetera. So how have you navigated the marriage waters, the brand new dad waters through this entire, you know, effort you're putting in? Because both take a lot of time and energy.
They do. I mean, to be honest, I think that I've given, well, like we talked about earlier, like my expectations on myself are higher than I'm able to deliver. And I want to be the best at this and do the best, give them the best, give this the best, like give everything the most attention and the best to myself. But I do think like I have not been on my kind of partner A game. So like when Farah and I met, I was just a poker player. I had run it once training, but it didn't take up a lot of my focus. It wasn't stressful at all. It wasn't a financial drain in any way. And it was around like the time we got married that I took on so much with the business. And I've definitely been more distracted. I've been more stressed. And you know, it's a much different life than being a poker player. Obviously being a poker player can be stressful, but I was fortunate, you know, to be a successful poker player and, you know, reasonably consistently. So it wasn't that stressful for me. I would, you know, you'd stop playing and you'd still have hands running through your head, but you could still like, you didn't have tasks hanging over your head. You could be in the moment and present. And so I definitely am not very happy with the, like, I mean, husband that I've been. I'm still like a nice person. I don't like take anything out on her, certainly. And I am, I'm just not as present. And she gets less of me than she did before because of the business. And I do want to figure that out. Since the baby's been born, I'm spending more time with the family. Mm-hmm. And I'm even just recently. So what I've been trying to do over the course of this last year is figure out where I'm important to the business and where I'm not so important to the business. Mm-hmm. At the beginning, I just felt like I had to learn it all and I had to be good at, you know, managing people. I had to learn to be good at marketing. I had to learn to be good at, you know, products. I like had to learn to be good at product testing and I was trying to do everything. And the reality is like, I'm not going to be good at everything. Like there are certain areas that don't interest me. I don't want to be good at them. I want to trust other people to be good at them. And so I've been finding my places to contribute most, which is, you know, being the face of the site. I've done some streaming on the site. I still have my hands very, very much in the product itself, like development decisions and, you know, direction of the company in that respect. I have a little bit to do with marketing, but not a lot in terms of like day to day. And I'm trying to pull back and use a little bit less of my time there and have a little bit more of that time and energy for the family, but also the time and energy for the areas that I'm better at and more helpful at. Yeah. And then also I really miss playing poker and I've found that, you know, basically not playing poker for 2 years, with the exception of, you know, short stints at the World Series or other things, was making me less happy. And I ended up not really enjoying the work I was doing. So I'm still trying to find, like I played this summer again, I've done a little bit of playing since, but I'm planning on doing some more playing coming up. And so I'm really trying to be like a half-time poker player, half-time focus on Run at Once Poker in the areas that I can be the most useful and helpful. And then be a present husband and father. That's my goal now.
Have full-time dad and husband on top of, you know, your businesses and your ambitions and et cetera. And, you know, on the podcast with Joey, he had mentioned something about like trying to find a balance of like selfishness with ambition and this or that. And I don't think ambition or being ambitious is selfish, right? I mean, I think it's just a great quality to have, but finding that balance for yourself, for the other people who are important to you in your life and making them a priority is a constant grind and you got to do it. And it sounds like you're doing it. You're making decisions to make sure you can be as present as you need and want to be for your family. Right. So
yeah, I'm trying to be, and I'm definitely like noticing over the last month, I've made some progress towards it, but I still have a ways to go. And the other nice thing is that I think like, I don't know what I really need to learn is like I said, to kind of earlier, is to finish a day and be satisfied with what I did, even if I didn't do everything that I could have done, because I never will. So I'm trying to do that. I've done a little better in the last month. Like I'm exercising for the first time in forever, for the last month. So that's good. It's just all these things that like you never, it doesn't feel like you have any time for,
right.
But if, you can make 30 minutes a day, and it makes a difference. And I think all of these things, you know, being a little healthier, getting some poker in, which is really like at the end of the day, yes, Run It Once poker is my passion, but poker's always been my main passion. I love playing poker and I miss it. And so getting that in, getting more time, more present time with my family, being healthier, finding that balance, I think is just going to make me better at all of the things that I'm doing.
Amen, brother.
Yeah.
And what does Farah's support mean to you through this whole thing?
It means a lot because she's been very understanding of it. Like admittedly, she's gotten less of me and the less, you know, she's gotten more stressed. More preoccupied husband than she signed up for. It really was like around that time that I changed, like, well, my circumstances changed and I changed with them. And she's, I mean, she's incredibly supportive and understanding. And you know, while she obviously would love for me to she enjoyed the way things were, and it's definitely harder on her, but she just understands, and she's, you know, she's got my back, and she knows it's harder on me too.
Yeah,
and we're trying to figure it out, but she's never been she's always been supportive. She's never been like a stressor, even through all of this. When I know that I'm not giving enough to her, she hasn't put that pressure on me. It's just self-imposed. Oh,
wow. That's great. Shout out to Farah. That's amazing.
Shout out to Farah. Yeah.
Shout out to Farah. Like I can relate, and I'm not going to take too much time on this, right? Cause this is about you, but just talking about this, I can relate. You put in so much of your time towards your business and for your family too. Right. Yeah. And then for me, it's like one thing that I will not sacrifice is my relationship with my kids. And present, and I'm going to be the best dad I can. And then you start realizing, oh crap, am I being the best husband I can be? And it's like, whoa. And then you got to make some adjustments because like Farah, my wife, Devin, is unbelievably supportive and doesn't ever put the extra stress on it too. Right. So shout out to Devin, shout out to Farah. And there you go.
Shout out to both of them.
All right, man. So as we wrap this thing up, right. I always ask a couple questions as we close, right? And I think so far, just so you know, like I think there's gonna be a lot of people that get a lot out of this conversation. Big time.
I hope so.
Yeah, especially with some of the advice you're giving. And just hearing that, I think for a lot of people too, Phil, who are on their journey, life journey, dad journey, business journey, just hearing that you know, especially if they know you and are a fan of yours or et cetera, kind of go through these things, it almost humanizes it for them. Like, and just sometimes the relatability is helpful.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. I find that the more people I talk to in kind of similar situations, it's just, yeah, it's how it goes.
So, all right. So if there's one thing that you really learned about yourself through this whole journey, what would it be?
Wow. I think that I learned that I don't want to say it this way like not everything always works out. I had kind of an easy life, and a lot of things that I dedicated myself to, I was successful at pretty like quickly. And this, you know, we've launched 4 businesses now. The training site's doing well. Run on Once Poker is alive, but struggling. And the other two are dead. They failed. You know, I think that not that I knew that I could do anything and succeed at anything. And I do still think that in the sense of working out, like things are going to work out. I'm going to be okay no matter what. But it was definitely, I don't know, not that I was arrogant, but kind of, which is just a dose of reality in that sense. And in, you know, future endeavors, I think, you know, when you're doing the EV calculation of everything you're taking on, I probably need to be giving more, like a higher probability than I would have in the past to like, you know, this might not work out as he planned. Right. And I think that even though I knew logically that that could happen, I kind of just always thought, you know, we're going to make this work. And sometimes that's not enough, and that's okay. You know, like it's the same in poker. I never had a problem with it. Like you try a play that you think is the best play and it doesn't work sometimes. And that's never bothered me. Right. Or you play as well as you can and you just lose because of, you know, circumstances out of your control or circumstances within your control. Maybe just, you know, you didn't play your best game, whatever it is. I've always been fine with that, but I guess like it was a difference to take on like a real project and a goal. Like we're going to build this, we're going to make it succeed. And then just, you know, very clearly fail at that. And that was kind of new to me. And so I know that's kind of a somber thing that I've learned, but it's the truth that, you know, you can try hard and, you know, you can be smart and make the best decisions you can. It's just not always going to work out.
Yeah.
And that's okay. Like in starting a business and people who invest in businesses know this, it's usually like, you know, it's usually an asymmetrical payoff where a lot of businesses fail and then the ones that make it do extremely well. And that's like, not always, but you know, a lot of businesses, when people go to invest, they look at that. They're like, you know what? I'm going to invest in this business. It might fail 75% of the time, but you know, when the 25% it succeeds, I'm going to 10X, 20X my return. So it's still a good investment. So like you can still be making a good play, but it's not always going to work out and you need to be prepared for that outcome.
Yeah. I think that's great advice or not just advice. I mean, unbelievable that you learned that about yourself, right? Yeah. So here's the thing in my mind, and this is kind of proven, a lot of times before a tipping point, there's a struggle because that struggle makes you realize what has to happen to hit that tipping point, right? So, and look, you've had four businesses, Run at One's training a success, the other two, not so much, Run at One, Poker on its way to being a success. This is a coin flip you're going to hit. Like, I really believe that.
Thank you. I hope you're right. And I definitely believe we can do it.
Yeah. Yeah. And belief is, that's what you need to do first and foremost is really believe it. And you do, and you will. So, all right. And then last but not least, brother. So to other aspiring entrepreneurs, or business folks, who are just starting out or are trying to get through, you know, their journey, what would you want them to know?
I think just like in poker, I guess it's kind of a lot, but you know, be prepared for things to not go at the, you know, the trajectory that you expect them to, or hope they go. Like it's easy to, like, you know, before a business launches, say like, these are our projections and, you know, it could go better, it could go worse. I know that, but actually be thinking in your mind, no, it's going to be one of the good ones. it's easy to like know logically, but still feel like that. And so you don't necessarily prepare for outcome B or C.
Right.
And so it's important, I think, just to have like, to have thought that out, you know, if it goes this way, great. What if it goes this way? What am I going to do? What's the backup plan? What should I be preparing for? Whether it's preparing to raise more money to make it work or preparing to pivot in some way. It's easy. Like you can't predict everything that's going to happen, but one thing that's easy to predict is doesn't grow as fast as you want, or it doesn't get finished as fast as you want, or it doesn't go exactly as you planned. And if that's the case, what's going to happen? So you don't have to panic in that moment and pivot and just rush to a solution.
Love it. I'm going to take that damn advice.
All right.
Because I'm dealing with some of that right now. And then you said you missed poker. So when are you going to play again, man? Where are you going to play? And
I miss it a lot. I'm going to play in a few days. There's some high stakes cash games that are going to run next week in Vegas.
Nice.
And then because you know, you can never be completely sure, if those fall through or don't go well, or I get tired of them, there's a Poker Masters also in Vegas this coming week, and I'll at least probably play the 25K PLO. It's
there you go.
Exciting event. Maybe the 10K PLO if nothing else is running, and we'll see. What else?
Well, you'll be playing on the feature table with those Faded Spade cards. So may the cards be with you, brother.
Thank you.
Well, we will tune in for that, and good luck during the cash games. And again, from our perspective, you know, Phil, this is going to be an unbelievable episode for our viewers or listeners.
I hope so.
Where can people connect with you on a more like kind of personal level on social media?
Yeah. So at Phil Galfond on Twitter is where I'm most active. I'm maybe at Phil.Galfond on Instagram, but I'm not too active there. And if you head to runatonce.eu and join our Discord, that's Run at Once Poker's Discord. You know, you can talk to me and some of the staff and a bunch of the players. We're all in there. And it's a great way, if you're interested in learning more about the site, or especially if you're interested in playing on the site, it's a great way to get your questions answered, talk to other people like you, try to get games started, see what's happening, find out about promotions. So that's where you probably could have even the most direct contact.
There you go. Well, I know I speak for everybody when we're excited to see what happens next. Right? What happens next with Runatonce Poker? And no doubt it's going to be on the positive side. The tipping point is happening. And everybody, we hope that you enjoyed this Founder Hour segment of the Faded Spade podcast, or apparently vodcast, which you can find on the brand new Faded Spade YouTube channel and across all major podcast outlets like Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, you name it. Phil, thanks for making the time, brother. I know we have a lot more business talks coming up, but thanks for making the time to do this, and have a great time playing. Keep up the great work in the dad life, and no doubt Runatonce Poker is that tipping point is coming.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It was fun.
All right, brother.
The Faded Spade podcast is sponsored by Duck Duck Productions. Contact them for all of your podcast editing needs at randy@duckduckpro.com.
Upgrade to Faded Spade and get 15% off the new face of cards with code PODCAST at FadedSpade.com.